Truth Seekers, Mike Malloy here. Did you watch the presidential press conference? Earlier today, before Obama gave his 100 days in office, and where did that come from? Where's this idea? I guess it's a press, it's a media creation. 100 days in office, the first 100 days. Well, he certainly gave the press conference that I think most of the media people wanted. I like the fact that Barack Obama is starting to, or has learned, apparently very, very quick learning curve on how to handle some of the smart asses in the crack White House press corps. But all in all, I thought his answers were fairly fairly clear and exact, except when he was asked about if waterboarding is torture and the previous administration authorized waterboarding, is the previous administration guilty of torture? Seems like a fairly simple equation. But still, he refuses to come right out and say, yeah, it was torture. So, and we're going to pursue it. I don't know why that just can't seem to be done, can it? At least not yet. Again, maybe there is a different plan, one that we don't know about. Let's hope. Let's hope. You never know, you know. Earlier today, Democrats endorsed the Obama budget. And I say Democrats because this was a $3.5 trillion spending plan, and it passed the House 233-193, and it passed the Senate 53-43. And in both houses was there not one single Republican vote, not one, nowhere. So I think it's clear a couple of things as a result of the budget vote. The Republicans truly have become strictly a group of obstructionists. There are many ways they could have cooperated with the Obama administration, the Democratic Party budget writers, in working some compromises on different issues. But instead of doing that, they just, tossed their asses in the air and walked around as though somebody had just hit them with a 2x4. Refused to sit down and talk. Obama, like him or not like him, appreciate his policies or not, I think he's bent over as far as he can bend over, which is one of Rush Limbaugh's favorite positions. He talks about it all the time. In order to reach these pointless Republicans, the Limbaughs, and he made a real effort when he came into office. And all he got back when he extended his hand from the Republicans was a handful of human feces. So, you know, why bother? Why bother? So I think the Democrats and the Obama administration are aware that they have a chance over the next 8 years because they're not going to lose seats in the 2010 election. That is simple. the Democrats are going to pick up seats in both houses. I guarantee you that. So I think the Obama administration recognizes that it has an opportunity here to change the course of the country on so many levels, and they've got 8 years to do it. I hope that over the course of the next two or three congressional elections, that real Democrats out here in crazy land will start pushing liberal Democrats into the party so that the Obama administration doesn't wind up just being kind of, like we talked about last night, a center-right a populist party, not really populist, but center-right, corporatist-slash-populist, if that's possible. But the Republicans have made it clear they want no part of this. So, okay, that's fine. I have no problem with that. As a matter of fact, I think it's a great idea. I think the Republicans ought to absolutely do nothing. When they go home to get reelected, they can tell their constituents, if their constituents are clear-headed enough, what am I talking about, to take a look at the record and see that their representatives in both the House and the Senate did absolutely nothing to turn the country around, did absolutely nothing for the constituents, that those constituents will say, look, you know, this is stupid. Come back and see me, Mr. Republican or Miss Republican, if you ever get your sense of ethical behavior back again. And I don't think that's ever going to happen. The Republicans are a dying collection of losers, misfits, gun nuts, Christers, and extreme right-wing racists. And they are doomed. They're dead. The party's dead. This is what I've been telling you. I've been talking about this for months, that the Republican Party need to be murdered. I had no idea that it was so intent on committing suicide, but it is. It truly, truly is. So never stand in the way when one of your enemies is putting a gun to his head. Just step back and, you know, cover your ears and go, la 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 la. The Democrats endorsed Obama's request for hundreds of billions of dollars in new spending over the next decade for college loans, which Republicans hate. Early childhood education programs, which the Republicans hate, both of those, because what Republicans want, what's left of the Republican Party, is for all children to go to private religious schools that kicks the Negroes and the Puerto Ricans and the Mexicans out on their asses, and that just the good, decent little Christian white children can go get a nice education about how God created the world, 60,000 years ago, or 6,000 years ago in 7 days. Or 6 days, actually, and then rested on the seventh. He also, Obama, suggested, and the Democrats fulfilled, extended benefits for military veterans. Republicans hate that. They hate the military, always have. They use the military as something that they pretend that they support when they hate it. It's just a way of motivating their brain-dead voters, and I think some of their brain-dead voters are starting to come out of the ether. Finally, after 25 years, I think Republican voters are starting to say, hey, wait a minute, not only have you not stopped the queers from getting married, but more and more states are saying they can. Wait a minute, not only have you not stopped a woman's right to privacy, but the bitches can still go get a procedure done and kill their fetus. Wait a minute, not only have you not stopped gun grabs, the Democrats don't seem interested. So, you know, that sort of thing. So I think the Republican voters, as brain dead as they are starting to realize that they've been used and abused and will continue to be, what the Republican voters need to do, and the columnist Sidney J. Harris suggested this years ago, back in the early 80s, it's not necessarily true anymore, but most European countries have their fascist party. And, they usually don't really use the name fascist, but it is fascist and everyone knows it is. And they pick up one or two or three seats in their parliaments every time they have elections, and then they'll lose in the next election and they'll come back with them. But Italy has fascists, France has fascists, Great Britain has fascists, I think Germany, the fascist party, has been made illegal for obvious reasons. I think in most countries, I don't know about the Scandinavian countries, but in most European countries, or if not most, several, let's put it that way, you find a fascist party. In America, there is no such thing. That's why the Republican Party has been eaten from the inside out. It was attacked by maggots, the maggots being the Christian fascists and the political fascists. So they, these maggots, launched a full-scale attack on a living body, the Republican Party, and this is what they've done to it. So the Republican Party is dead. Perhaps what can happen is that the people who continue to make up the core, the maggot-infested core of this so-called Republican Party, will now get honest and just say, look, we are not that at all. We're not Republicans. We're not the party of Lincoln. Jesus Christ. We're the party of Adolf Hitler. That's what we believe in. White supremacy. Fortress America. We are going to start calling ourselves the American National Socialist Party. And we invite all of you to join us. Wouldn't that be fun?
I say, are you fascist about the news? You fascist about the news? You fascist about the news? You're about the news? You fascist about the
He's a liberal with a microphone, and that makes him dangerous. It's Mike Malone.
21 past the hour. As far as where did the 100 days come from? Okay, I know Marcus, who's listening in Munich, Germany, tonight, emails in that the 100 days comes from FDR making reports after instituting programs for the recovery from the Great Depression. During the time, there was great dissent of the previous style of government and economics, and talks flourished of wanting socialism and even communism in its place. Imagine that, yeah. Okay, thanks, thanks, Marcus. Appreciate it. Well, I didn't know. Did you know? Were that 100 days, you know, making a report, the first 100 days? I have no idea. Now we know. Also in the, what we're talking about here for a couple of minutes is, the House and the Senate, approved Barack Obama's, Obama's budget plan, $3.4 trillion spending plan. This, sets the stage for Obama to pursue the first major overhaul of the nation's healthcare system in a generation. The Democrats, because the Republicans completely dropped out of this, the fascists dropped out of it. You know, if the Republicans are so funny, compromise to them means do it our way or the highway. And we had 8 years of that, and look how they destroyed the country. Just absolutely goddamn destroyed the country. So now that they can't continue to destroy the country, they're all pouting like the little, playground bullies that they are. It's just weird to watch. I swear it is. It is just weird to watch these little whiny asses do what they're doing, these Republicans. But anyway, you know, ultimately it's a good thing. Go away, schmucks. Just go away. Don't bother your betters in the Senate. Don't bother your betters in the House. And disappear. So what I was saying right before the break, if the Republicans the people who now own the Republican Party, they're not Republicans, if they would have the courage of their convictions, they would declare themselves the American Fascist Party and be done with it. I guess it's because the word fascist has such a corpse-like sound to it, death and destruction, but that's what Republicans are about. They could change it to something else, call themselves the American Sunflower Party if they want to. I don't give a damn. Just, you know, just at least stop calling yourself Republicans. What is it down to now? 19% of the, in polls, 19% of Americans still consider themselves Republican? 19%? Dear God. Okay. Well, there's your base for the American Fascist Party. Or the American Sunflower Party. You know, there it is, that 19%. That's a lot of potential voters. Go for it, you jerks. And in the meantime, just get out of the way. Go march around in the woods or something. Go raise your hands up and wait for a Jesus hook to come down and pull you up with the rapture. I don't know. Whatever you want to do, just get out of the way, please. Where was I? Oh, yeah. Overhaul of the healthcare system. Now, it's not going to be single payer, and that's horrible and awful, and I hate it, and so do you, but that's where we are. So what do you want to do? We can sit here with our thumbs in our butts and bitch and whine and talk about the awfulness of it, or we can accept this and then get to work to elect liberals who will change it, right? But I think it should be very clear to every Democrat, that is every rational human being who is of voting age, that Barack Obama is A, not a liberal, B, not a liberal, C, C above. So he is in so many areas a progressive. If we define progressives now as anything other than Republican, which is what we've kind of come down to. Now, please don't send me an email with a long, detailed explanation of how both parties are exactly the same and he's a corporatist and yada, yada, yada. You know, I'm not denying that Barack Obama, like any other candidate for president, is a, quote, corporatist, end quote. I mean, that's where we are. That's what you and I did. We allowed this to happen. Now, not you. You didn't ever vote Republican. Neither did I. But, you know, this didn't just pop up out of a cellar somewhere. This has been going on slowly since Eisenhower, a Republican for Christ's sake, tried to warn us, don't let this happen. But that was 50-some years ago and nobody paid attention. So here we are. Barack Obama is not going to come into office and A, change it, and B, I don't think he has that much of a problem with being a corporatist president, if he is the right sort, if you understand what I'm saying. So if those of us on the liberal side of the equation, if we don't want to continue conservative, democratic policies, then what we have to do is, you know, get up off our asses and get to work nominating, selecting, and electing liberal candidates. Right? Right. We'll be back in a minute.
Life is funny. Skies are sunny. Bees make honey.
Mike Malloy Show. Talk radio matters here.
Before the hour. So anyway, getting back to the budget plan, Barack Obama's $3.4 trillion spending plan, and the fact that it was passed today on his 100th day with not a single Republican vote, not one, which is not to say that all the Democrats, there might have been one or two or three Democrats who voted against this, but it passed the House 233 to 193. It passed the Senate 53 to 43. And again, of all the Republican Limbots, I should say the Limbot Party in the Congress, in both houses, not a one, not a single Republican voted for this spending plan. There will be money for college loans, new dollars, billions for college loans, early childhood education programs, benefits for military veterans, investments in renewable energy. And then there's this. Lawmakers also agreed to use a powerful procedural tool from the quiver of arcane instruments that the House and the Senate uses to, or the House and Senate use to, help each other along or stop each other cold in their tracks. It's stuff that you and I would have no more idea how it works than how sausage is made, but it's known as reconciliation. And if I understand it right, it has nothing to do with reconciling different ideas. It has to do with getting a plan past the potential filibuster stage. It's called reconciliation, and they're using this to advance Obama's proposal to expand health coverage for the uninsured. So that was passed as, I guess, an amendment to the budget or an add-on or whatever. Now, this is not like in 1993 when Bill Clinton, actually Hillary Clinton, unveiled this universal coverage plan that went nowhere on Capitol Hill. But Obama now has a strong mandate, it says here, for change from both chambers of Congress and a mid-October deadline for key congressional committees to figure out what they want in terms of universal health care and on both the then sent to the full House and the full Senate. So come the middle of October, if any of us are still alive, this plan will be presented. We'll move out of the committees that are studying this, that are taking testimony, holding hearings, and become full-blown proposed legislation. So we'll see what happens, huh? Now, this thing was not a slam dunk for Obama. According to the AP, lawmakers trimmed Obama's tax-cutting plans by refusing to extend his signature tax credit for working families past 2010, unless it's paid for. Whatever that means, there's not going to be anything paid for. I mean, black ink, there's not going to be a budget surplus for what, the next 10, 15, 20 years? I mean, it's crazy. So Obama wanted tax credits for working, the so-called working, working poor. I hate that expression. Anybody in this country who works should not fall into a category of poor, for Christ's sake. I mean, think about it. Hi, you got a job? Yeah, but I'm in the working poor. Oh, really? Okay. So that will stop in 2010. They sliced $10 billion from his spending request for non-defense programs in the next fiscal year, the one that begins next October. Remember what we're working on right now. We are working on a Bush budget. That's what we have right now. Obama has the power to order funds pulled from where. I have no idea. Don't email me and ask me. And don't email me and tell me, because it'll just make my head hurt. But we are still operating. Don't these budgets run from October to October, I think? The fiscal years? I think. I don't know. I don't want to know. And also, they dumped, the Republicans dumped his suggestion that another $250 billion would be needed to stabilize the banking system. From what I read in the New York Times business section today, the banking industry is starting to get a little pissy about what the attachments are to all this money they've been sucking out of our wallets. You know, that credit card commercial, what's in your wallet? Right now, nothing, because the banking industry has sucked everything out of it. But along with the money that they're taking from us, and by that I mean the hook that they're putting us on for the next 10, 15 years, there are certain parameters within which the banking industry, a bunch of thieving sons of bitches and liars and cheats, if ever they existed, this is why the banking industry ought to be just absolutely destroyed. We should have a national bank that is truly national. It should be run by the government, whoever the government is. It should be monitored and overseen by people with machine guns, so that the first banker who tries to run a scam like has been perpetrated against us for the past 10 years, he'll be immediately pulled from his Mercedes, taken out behind the columns, and executed. Boom. That's it. End of story. Very simple, huh? Very simple. Why should bankers and these financial crazy people be allowed to destroy everything? I mean, goddamn, if somebody runs into a house and starts shooting people, and when we catch him, depending on what state he's caught in, we'll probably execute him. What about these banking monsters and financial services goons who have created this system where they, I mean, they might as well be eating our flesh. They might as well, they are, they're cannibals. They're devouring a system that is difficult as it is to try to live within, this capitalist corrupt system. But these sons of bitches are making it even worse and worse and worse. Why aren't they? Immediately, upon presentation of irrefutable evidence, a very quiet bullet. I mean, that doesn't have to be machine gun. That makes too much noise. It'll disturb the other people working in the bank. You know, just take them out and back and, you know, I don't know what, a 9mm Glock? Pew, pew, pew. That's it. It's all over. And they won't do it again. See? And then when word filters back into the bank of what has just happened, you know, that'll give some of them pause. Not all of them. There will be other bank monsters who will say, oh, well, you know, Ralph, he was such a dumbass, he got caught. Ain't going to catch me. But I digress. So, while Obama tries to continue to shore up, and a lot of you write to me with these emails about how this is one of the, this and the national security issues, this is the one area where Obama is really screwing up. The banks ought to be defanged. Everything ought to be taken from them. Everything. Just remove the entire financial system from the banks. Take it away. That's it. You guys have had 200 years. Look what you've done. It's over. Now go do something else. Go try to sell some of these used Chevrolets sitting over here in a parking lot somewhere. Just get out of town. It's over. And then set up a board of economists headed by Paul Krugman and who's the other guy that I like so much, Kathy? Drawing a blank on his name now. Let them run a board of overseers, and the board will consist of people, like I said, who are fully armed in case these people get a little bit weird. Huh? What? Simple solution? Well, okay. Yeah, I think so. So Obama has 8 years here to do some pretty heady stuff, and I hope he does. Is he going off on the wrong track, in our opinion, yours and mine, because we're liberals? Oh, yeah, of course. But again, as Molly Ivan said, you dance with the one who brung you, and that's him and us. So if we had any illusions about who Barack Obama was, it's our fault. His record was there. His associations were there. We talked about it. I said it over and over and over and over and over again on this program. We are not electing, if we elect Barack Obama, a liberal. He is not a liberal. There's even question if he's progressive. This is a center-right, with the emphasis on center, government, as opposed to neo-fascist government that we had for 8 years that was illegitimate to begin with. They weren't even voted in. Sons of bitches stole everything. So anyway, you work with what you got, or leave the country, or kill yourself, or sit around with your thumb in your butt and just complain about how bad things are, or get out and start the organizing process, and fully understanding that you may not live to see it come to fruition. You may not live that long. Start the organizing process to put together a liberal, or as one listener suggested, Tom, a labor party, to fight the conservative Democratic Party, the corporatist Democratic Party that is now in control. I don't know why this is hard. I'll tell you why it's hard, because most of us are either unemployed or tired or sick of the struggle, or have been struggling since 1960s or earlier, and just don't know where in the hell to pull out the reserves anymore. The younger generation is going to be radicalized because as they all flood the labor market, they're going to look around and say, Jesus Christ, where are the jobs?
listening to Mike Malloy. Turn down your speakers. It'll be our secret.
It's about 10 before the hour. Also today, a Spanish judge, Baltazar Garzon, who once tried to extradite former Chilean dictator and CIA puppet Augusto Pinochet, that judge has started a criminal investigation into torture detainees at Guantanamo. And he said he would target both U.S. military personnel and those who issued their orders. He said he will be basing his case on testimony in his court by four former Guantanamo detainees who, I don't know if they're Spanish citizens or not, but they appeared in his court. They complained of physical and mental abuse at the base in Cuba, i.e. torture. The judge, Garzon, called Guantanamo a legal limbo, and as such, fell under universal jurisdiction. How about that? Which allows him to investigate what went on in the base, even though Obama has promised to close it. Garzon became internationally famous for his pursuits of Pinochet and Argentine military officers. And his actions, of course, set precedents, I should say, for the principles that certain serious crimes can be prosecuted anywhere in the world. What a novel idea. Judge Garzon listed possible perpetrators of criminal acts at Guantanamo. And he said, quote, members of the U.S. Army and military intelligence and all those who put into practice or designed a systematic plan of torture or abuse, end quote. The judge said he would ask U.S. authorities for copies of documents declassified by the Obama administration detailing the practices, such as partial drowning. Garzon said in his ruling, quote, these memos reveal what had previously been suspected, an authorized systematic plan for the torture and maltreatment of people deprived of their liberty without charge and without the most basic rights granted to any detainee, end quote. The judge detailed a list of abuses against the four men who appeared in his court, including sexual assault, beatings, subjection to extreme heat and cold, continual interrogation at any time of day or night, sleep deprivation, long periods in shackles and handcuffs, and partial drowning. Garzon's criminal investigation comes just 6 weeks after Spain's most famous judge was forced to give up an attempt to initiate a probe into six former Bush administration officials, including Alberto Gonzalez over Guantanamo, after criticism from Spanish legal authorities. Spain is still wallowing in its post-fascist experimentation that goes all the way back to the 30s, right? But one of the human rights lawyers who had presented the criminal complaint against the six officials, Cheney and the rest of these thugs, said that Garzon's latest ruling was far more than they had hoped for it went after not only the perpetrators of abuse, but also their bosses. So we'll see what happens. Maybe it sets a precedent. Spanish legal advisors said, no, don't go after Addington and you and Gonzalez and Bybee. I said Cheney, didn't I? I don't think Cheney was in that original group. But this judge is not somebody to take lightly. It was through his efforts that the CIA dictator put in place in Chile after the CIA ordered assassination of the duly elected president, although only with a plurality, Once that assassination took place and they were able to put Pinochet in, and he lasted for the next several decades. That was a combination, CIA and a Henry Kissinger operation. And the result of that, of course, it wasn't too bad. You know, maybe 30,000 people murdered and tortured. So it's just too bizarre. Damn it! I don't want to talk about this stuff. I don't. I know. Let's talk about something a little more pleasant. Swine flu. How about swine flu? According to a member of the World Health Organization, these claims of 150 people have died so far from swine flu are not completely correct. The WHO officially has recorded only 7 deaths around the world. I only bring this up not to dispute any number or any claim by any government or any health organization, but only to show the politics of disease now, the politics of pandemics and epidemics. And the fact that we're going to debate, you see, we're going to get into furious debates about, well, how many are really dead? Well, is that really? Well, no. What did the pathology report say? Well, are you sure that's a virus? Did it come from pigs? No, it came from birds. No, it didn't. It's not swine flu. It is swine flu. No, wait a minute. Let's move up to level 5. No, we should stay at level 4. God damn, what's going on? Well, I'll tell you what. This is all a plot by the pharmaceutical industry. No, it isn't. You know full well, Malloy, the Tamiflu is owned by, what's his name? Donald Rumsfeld. No, this is not trial. That's the way it goes. No. In the meantime, we're all going to die. We'll just all goddamn die. Let's all stand around and do this. This is great fun. Let's argue about how many have died. Let's argue about who caused it. Let's argue that it was a NAFTA-inspired pig farm owned by Swift and Company dumped over the border of Mexico. Yeah, okay, let's do that. Let's all do that. Let's just talk it and talk it and talk it and politicize and argue. There's nothing like politicizing disease. I mean, that always makes great sense, right? Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour. How about a report here from Prairie 2, since we're going to move into a little discussion here about the swine flu. I guess that's what we're supposed to call it. The World Health Organization, the CDC, or somebody said, nah, let's call it swine flu. Okay, instead of H1N1, let's call it swine flu. Much easier for us here in America because we're not the brightest collection of travelers, are we? Anyway, Prairie 2 writes, the U.S. gross domestic product, you know, the sum total of all our goods and services, continued to decline at a more than 6% rate for the first quarter of this year, surprising yet again the clueless economists who predicted a much better number. This seems to be the hook used on every story about new economic numbers. The numbers are either better than expected or they're much worse than expected. Unfortunately, they are always, almost always, worse. The World Health Organization is warning the world's governments to expect a flu pandemic and that they should be prepared for a prolonged health crisis. Economists have not put out any estimates on what the pandemic will do to the world economy. Assuming a workable vaccine is possible, it will still be 2010 before any meaningful number of people can be treated, even in the developed countries. At the rate this outbreak is progressing, it probably won't matter much by then. State labs across the country are referring probable cases to the CDC. Look for tomorrow's headlines to be much more dramatic than today's. Obama has suggested that parents should make contingency plans for when the schools are closed. I hope he is making contingency plans, Prairie 2 writes, for when large swaths of the country are closed. I'm sure the economists will be surprised at the numbers. On the effectiveness of masks, surgical masks are intended to protect the patient and do almost nothing to protect the wearer. Tight-fitting masks work but only as long as they stay dry, which is about 2 hours, and should not be reused. A respirator-style mask would be better if you have the right filters, but those only have a limited life as well. The only practical measures are to keep people in at a distance and never, ever touch your nose, your eyes, with your hands. Maybe wear a bucket on your head. Prairie2.com. Go give him hell for that. Prairie2.com. A bucket on my head? Huh.
Tell the audience what you want to do after the show tonight at midnight.
Kathy.
Hey, if you're going to talk about Prairie 2, I think it's only fair that the audience knows what you want to go do after the show at midnight tonight.
After the show at midnight tonight. Oh, yeah, go. It's about 10 miles away to one of the all-night, I wasn't sure what you were referring to there, sweetheart. One of the all-night grocery behemoths here in the foothills of the North Georgia Mountains. And Prairie 2, if you're listening, I was going to go over there. I may still. And stock up on canned goods and some beans and oatmeal and, you know, some canned beans for sure. But dried beans, rice, maybe some... what else? Some hot spices. Water?
Beer.
Yeah. Beer. Yeah, a lot of beer.
Raid.
Some Raid. This is real funny. This is real knee slapper stuff, isn't it? Huh? Ha ha! The world is ending. Let's make a joke.
Matches.
Matches, certainly. So anyway, yeah, I had talked about doing that. And may still do it. Now, I have a thought problem for you. Is that what they call it? I have a family doctor. He is an internist. And we have a pediatrician. She is a pediatrician. They're both MDs, obviously. So the other day when this first broke, I was talking to a friend of mine, this story about this, here we go. With the possibility of pandemic, I was talking to a friend of mine who said, well, just, you know, call your doctor and get a course of Tamiflu, one for you and one for Kathy. I said, oh, yeah, okay, that makes sense. So I called both physicians, and within about 6 or 7 hours, our family physician, the internist, called back, and he said, what's the matter? Do you get a little nervous? I said, well, yeah, but the reason I'm calling and asking you for a script for one course of treatment for me and one for Kathy, is a couple of things. First of all, I'm at an age where I'm susceptible to these viral attacks. A, B, I have a 4.5-year-old who brings everything home in terms of bugs, and I don't mean little crawly ones. And, that's the primary thing is trying to protect myself from getting this thing and dying. So if I do develop the specific symptoms, I said to my doctor, I would like to be able to just reach into the medicine cabinet and pop, start taking Tamiflu. Even though I know it's all run by, the former defense secretary and, you know, I, at this point, you know, I don't care about this stuff anymore. I really don't. I don't give a damn what Rumsfeld does or what he did do. He's a murderous son of a bitch. You know, I don't care where he's got money invested. I really don't. May he rot in hell. So I talked to my doctor and I said, yeah, I would like to have it available. I said, you know, I've never taken a antiviral medication that I'm aware of. Usually when I get these damn things, I just ride them out. That's why, in the fall, it seems like I'm sick all the time because I have this little kid who keeps bringing this stuff home. He said, well, all right, I'll go ahead and phone it into your drugstore. So he did. And Kathy and I went over later on that evening and picked it up. You know, just two packets. I think there's 10 tablets in each packet. You take two a day for 5 days, and you got to do it within the first 48 hours, is that it, that you developed these specific symptoms, you know, flu symptoms. This is not a treatment for swine flu. It's a treatment for flu. Okay. The next morning, Molly's pediatrician called, and she said, I'm sorry, I can't do this. And I said, okay. And before I could say why not, she said, because it's unethical. It's hoarding. I don't think it's proper for me to prescribe medication for people who are not sick. We all know, she went on, we all know that there's a good chance for this epidemic or pandemic, whatever you want to call it, and we all know that there's a good possibility a lot of people will get sick. But to start writing scripts now, before people develop the symptoms, to me, it's just like when there's a gasoline shortage, if people start filling up their tanks and driving the price up further. And I said, well, Dr. Blank, you know, my main reason for doing this, second main reason, my first main reason is to protect my child. My second main reason is if this thing does hit the area that we live in the preschool that she goes to, I would like to be able to just start her on a course of treatment. Rather than try to make an appointment, come in, wait, and perhaps at that point there would be such a run on whatever antivirals are available that it would be possible to get anything. She said, "Well, I'm just not going to do it because it is unethical for me to do this as a medical provider, and I don't agree with the philosophy. If anything happens, don't worry, just bring Molly." And we'll take care of it. Besides, Tamiflu is not something that you prescribe for children anyway. I said, okay. That was the last thing she said rather than saying that right at the very beginning. So, you know, I said, okay, I hear you. And hung up. So here I have one physician who said sure, another physician who said it's unethical. And I am kind of stuck. You know, I'm thinking, okay, if the pediatrician said it's unethical, should I call our internist back and say, look, did I put you on the spot? Should I, you know, return these? Of course, should I throw them away? What the hell should I do? So I'm going to open up the lines, and I'm going to ask you that question. Just what do you think the answer to that situation is? Okay, we're going to limit the calls to that topic right now. I want to hear what you got to say. The number here is 877-996-2556.
It's in the tide of negative news. Liberal lies and left-leaning views that our enemies would spread. Keep that bucket on your head.
Your Day Screaming with Mike Malloy.
Past the hour, regarding that question, Roz in Canada writes, it's the same thing here. No doctor will prescribe the antiviral or any antibiotic if you're not sick. It's just not done. That makes perfect sense to me. And the only reason I asked either of our two family doctors, Molly's pediatrician and the doctor that he and his partner take care of Kathy and me. The only reason I asked is because this seemed like an unusual situation that could result in, I don't know, I kept thinking, and I wanted to say to my doctor, you know, I was a Boy Scout, and we have this thing called Be Prepared, but I got the sense that he, you know, he was willing to do it because, you know, he's been my family physician here now for Kathy, well, for me anyway, for the past 10 years, and his partner has been Kathy's physician now for about the past 4 or 5, you know, general physician, general medicine. But anyway, let's see what you got to say. Brad is calling from Dallas, listening on KMNY. Brad, welcome to the program.
Thanks, sir. Yeah, interesting that you bring the question up. Actually, my partner's HIV. I'm not. And so I called our doctor, who is an HIV doctor, yesterday to get a packet of Tamiflu in the event.
Right.
You know, one of us gets sick, and it was a definite no.
He said no.
Yeah, prescribing it only in the event he gets sick.
Huh.
So I found that kind of interesting.
Was there any reason? The pediatrician that our daughter uses came right out and said she's very, you know, outspoken, this doctor, and she just said we love her to death. She's been a great doctor for Molly, but she said it's unethical.
Yeah, it didn't say anything about ethics, or it was just a no.
Huh.
So that's coming from the great state of Texas that wanted to secede 2 weeks ago, and now our governor's going to the national government wanting Tamiflu.
Yeah, isn't that something? What did he want? 34,000 doses, or courses of you know what? There's 10 to a pack or something.
Exactly. After giving it a little bit of thought, I mean, I guess it is somewhat unethical to give drugs if you're not sick, because you may be taking away drugs from someone that is sick. I actually have a friend who emailed me yesterday that he has an anesthesiologist friend who wrote him a prescription for it. And it's a good question. Good question.
Yeah, I guess there's more at play when you get into a situation like this, like the possibility of a pandemic invasion. There's more at play, and I think people who are dealing with chronic illnesses, like you and your partner, are more keenly tuned to the variations here. I think most people, obviously, I mean, this is a stupid kind of obvious statement, but most people would rather be well than be sick.
Right.
On the other hand, if there is something out there that will, be potentially fatal if you don't get the meds right away, that raises a question to me that if the medications are available, why not distribute them? It's not like there's a Tamiflu shortage. You know what I'm saying? Now, one, I guess, could develop if 300 million Americans all of a sudden started saying, I want my Tamiflu. I guess a shortage could develop. But, well, anyway, listen, thanks, Brad. I appreciate what you had to say, okay?
Sure enough. Thank you.
All right, sir. Take care. Cindy is calling from Kelso, Washington. Hey, Cindy.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, welcome to the program. Thanks for all the emails. I don't answer, but I do read them.
Oh, I know that. Okay. I figure you get 1,000 a day, you can't answer.
that's true.
I feel guilty flooding your mailbox.
That's all right.
However, I called about the Tamiflu because you said stick to the subject.
I'm sorry. Say that last sentence again. I got distracted there for a second. What did you say, Cindy?
I called about the Tamiflu
right,
because I'm sticking to the subject.
Oh, good, good.
And I think you should keep it and use it. I think that the very fact that you have it is the luck of the Irish, and you should just not worry about the ethicalness of whether or not.
Well, but I can't not. I mean, the ethical question never came up in my mind. It just honestly didn't. As a matter of fact, when Kathy and I talked about, you know, when I said, well, look, I think I'll call the two docs and get some Tamiflu, it just seemed like the normal thing to do. I mean, just natural. Yeah, you know, you get ready. That's all you do. You just get ready.
I called my doctor and asked the same thing and was told it's not available here yet.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, All right. Well, Cindy, thanks. We got a break. I appreciate what you had to say, okay?
Okay.
All right. Take care. Take care. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
Just had another cup of coffee. Here's Mike Malloy.
Twenty-five before the hour, there's one a postscript to my little thought problem there, and that is after I got the Tamiflu and brought it home. You know, read the precautions and the contraindications and yada, yada, yada. You know, there wasn't anything too weird in the literature, which is always suspicious because to me, most pharmaceuticals carry with them the potential to destroy you completely, murder you, kill you. And I, you know, I accept that. I'm not a medicine freak by any means. So I went online and Googled Tamiflu and oh, Jesus. Oh my goodness. So maybe that's why Molly's pediatrician opted not to phone in one for Molly. This stuff can be lethal to children. Raging Lefty also sent me a link here and you know, basically the same thing that that I read the other day. So you know, I printed it off and gave it to Kathy and said, you know, you might want to read this. Because it's, you know, we all know this. Kathy and I make a joke about the fact that whenever you hear a pharmaceutical commercial on the air, usually during the evening news, because apparently that's when all old people listen, and as the pharmaceutical industry knows, all old people are desperately ill, at least in the world of pharmaceuticals. So, if you listen to these commercials, if you have the stomach for it, almost every single one of them, you know, they're required by law now, or FCC regs, I guess, to at least touch on some of the expected or potential side effects. And what Kath and I have noticed lately is how many of them list as, in the commercials list as a side effect death. As one of the side effects, stroke, heart attack, death, cancer. You know, all the big three, well, it doesn't say you're going to get diabetes, but, the big two, cancer and heart disease, a heart attack as a result of taking these medicines. And then it says, you know, I love the way they work into that. Brand X is not for everyone and you may want to talk with your physician, you know, and then they list the potential downside of their drug. So no, I, you know, the pharmaceutical industry, the pharmaceutical industrial complex is really most of their stuff is symptomatic for symptomatic relief anyway. It doesn't really cure stuff. I think the last big push by the pharmaceutical companies to find cures was antibiotics. The HIV drugs reduce the load of the viral load inside a body, but you know, no one with any ethical background would make a claim that there's any drug out there that cures AIDS. You know, it makes it a disease with which one can survive in the same way that, not in the same way, but in the same basic idea as taking insulin, can stave off what usually waits for most type 1 diabetics. Or is it type 2? I don't even know. So the whole issue of these drugs, sure, I completely agree that the best way to handle illness is to let your body handle it. And I agree with that 1,000%. So much of my adult life was spent where I just didn't have health insurance for whatever reason. I just didn't have it. Either I didn't have a job that provided it, or I was irresponsible and didn't get it, or I was invincible and immortal and therefore didn't need it, or whatever. And not having health insurance certainly limited, my going to a doctor, or certainly not an emergency room. When I would get sick, I would just, ride it out. I was still doing that when I met Kathy, and, Kathy is different. Kathy does not believe in riding things out. Kathy will start heading for the medicine chest as soon as, I'm not slamming you, my dear. I'm just saying it's a different.
Oh no, you're not wrong. No, right. I mean, it's give me the meds. I was in labor and Molly was crowning, and I'm huffing and puffing on my way to the emergency room, going epidural. I'm like, honey, it's too late. I'm like, what the hell do you mean it's too late?
Well, that's not really.
Give me the drugs.
And of course, that's not really an illness. So anyway.
No, I don't hesitate. You break an aspirin in half.
I do.
And I'm not joking. I mean, listen, folks, Mike breaks aspirin in half.
I don't believe in drugs. I really don't, unless they're recreational, and that's only for adults. But anyway, I digress. I've not spent a lot of time with doctors and medications. And I take two of them right now, but that's only because of the business I'm in. If I get out of this damn business, I could drop both the medications. My doctor has said that to me. But Tamiflu, like so many of these monster drugs, carries with the potential to either kill you or make you insane, or both. It's almost like a god from a drug from the gods. Those whom the gods would destroy, they first make crazy. Is that what it, something like that? Anthony is calling from Lansing, Michigan, listening on Sirius. Hey, Anthony.
Hi, how you doing, Mike?
I'm all right. How are you?
Not too bad. And in reference to your question whether what you did was good or bad, I believe what you did was 100% prudent. Just about everything we do in this world is to make sure we are taken care of. And when it comes to your family, that's job one.
Yeah, that's true. And that was what, I hope that's what motivated me. It certainly wasn't a feeling that, I'm going to run in and get mine before someone else can get theirs. I guess I thought that, Tamiflu was not a drug that was in short supply. And I didn't realize there was an ethical, component to, at least question to getting it. So.
Well. I'm listening to what the information I was on hold, and you found out how serious Tamiflu is. And
right.
You got to realize that when it comes to medications, and I myself have tried to get materials licensed, and I was involved with a chemical, and we had to get it licensed as potentially causing death.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the reason it could potentially cause death was because it was a liquid. And because it was a liquid, you could drown in it. So can it cause death? Yes. And so with medications, again, they go way, way out there to include and encompass every possible disaster available. So reading those labels, you were mentioning, that they come
right.
from the gods. They wipe out those they're meant to and wipe out those that they're not.
Right.
But everybody is an individual, even our temperature at 98. Something is
right.
standard. Some of us it's up, some of us it's down. Everything is the standard. And what you make for one medication for 100 million, billion, zillion people may not work 100 billion, zillion people.
Yeah.
And I think what you did was absolutely correct. If I had a family, I would want to take care of myself to take care of them. Good job, sir. Keep up the good work. And great show.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Anthony. I appreciate what you had to say. Jason is calling from Buffalo, New York, listening online. Hey, Jason.
Hey, Mike. How you doing tonight?
I'm all right.
I just called. I'm a pharmacist. I talked to you about a month ago about the whole Federal Reserve thing.
Oh, yeah. How you doing, Jason?
Good. I just wanted to let you know about how my day went at the old drug corral and the constant questions and phone calls and stuff about this swine flu thing. I don't think you did necessarily wrong by being concerned, but my issue with people hoarding drug or taking things that they may not need is the fact that if they're taken improperly or too much, you end up building resistance.
Yeah, well, that's one of the reasons I've always tended to stay away from antibiotics.
Right.
Because if you might want to get that before it explodes.
Yeah, I got it.
I stay away from antibiotics on the theory, my own little theory that, at some late stage in my life, I might get some super infection that will kill me unless I have penicillin. And if I've gotten to the point where I have I have completely destroyed my body's ability to respond to penicillin, then I've just committed suicide. So I tend to stay away from antibiotics. Unless absolutely the doc is convinced it's bacterial and not viral.
Right, and the thing is, it's not necessarily an individual's response to it. It's what you end up creating. You create resistant viruses or bacteria if too many people use it in the wrong way.
Hey, hold on a second. Let me put you on hold, Jason. I'll come back because I want to hear what your take is on this whole thing. I'm Mike Malloy. Stay with us. Oh, you're not playing. Yeah, you are.
This is the end. My only friend, the end of our elaborate plans, the end of everything that stands, the end. No safety, no surprise.
Right here, right now, Mike Malloy.
It is 10 before the hour, and we're talking with Jason in Buffalo, New York, who is also a pharmacist. Now, what has been in Buffalo, which I know has really suffered through this economic meltdown, and before that, I know there's a lot of people there who are in Buffalo who are not having it real good, as they would say. What has been the response in the community, thinking that this may happen, this epidemic may happen, or this pandemic, and because Tamiflu is expensive. Thank God my union provides insurance for me that covers most of it, but it's an expensive drug.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that I got overly inundated today with calls, but there was a number of people concerned and wondering what they should do. And
right.
Probably the most notable one was a nurse practitioner that uses our store, and she called, and she was a little anxious about the whole situation, especially with her elderly parents.
Mm-hmm.
And I discussed the whole situation, how I felt that the media has been blowing this whole thing out of proportion. I mean, if you look at the numbers on number of people that have died in this country, it's only been one. And
right.
I think as of tonight, they said maybe 93 people were confirmed to have had it. I mean, that's mm-hmm. very, very low.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the amount of people that get the regular flu.
Well, right, and you're right. I think the point, though, Jason, is that this is a virus against which there is nothing. I mean, this is like HIV virus in that regard. I mean, there's nothing.
Right, but I wouldn't say that I can't say that we have seen where people, every single person that has come down with this or contracted it has dropped dead.
No, as a matter of fact, in the United States, it so far, it has, as far as anyone knows, it has a zero mortality rate. The child that came to Houston, it was from Mexico and he came for treatment.
Right.
So yes, and it's a tragic story. It's a horrifying story. It's a child who died in this country. But in the point of fact, epidemiologists would not consider him to be an American, death.
Okay.
Even though it happened here. So, but I think what has most people alarmed in the scientific community, certainly, head of the WHO, the woman I saw on television today, Asian, I don't know what, Asian, Chinese or Japanese or whatever, but the person who said that the World Health Organization was raising the alert level to the second highest from a 4 to a 5 because it's in 12, 13, 14, 15 countries now. And this is not new. I mean, we have been watching this. The medical community, I should say, the international medical community has been watching this particular virus or a virus similar to it as it's been slowly emerging, first in Asia, and then it would disappear and then it would pop up again. And as it's over the past decade, I believe, while it has been, and swine flu goes all the way back to the 70s. You know, it's like an emerging virus that is trying to do that thing that all organisms do, whether they're living organisms or viral organisms, and that is to get its genetic material spread as far and wide as it possibly can.
Right.
So one of the theories I've heard is that the reason the cases, so many cases are mild, it's almost like, and I realize I'm really turning a virus into a thinking sentient being, and I shouldn't do this, but it's almost like the virus is trying to figure out a way to infect and spread as far as it can. And you know, if it kills the host, it defeats its own purpose.
Sure.
So if someone has this viral load and spreads it around, and the person spreading it doesn't really die, doesn't get that sick, but the virus then continues to spread, continues to mutate, continues to figure out new ways to invade cell walls and replicate itself. You see where I'm going with this?
I absolutely see where you're going with this.
So I think that's the reason that there is concern about this. It's not just another flu. It probably is, but so far it isn't. it's one that's, what's this?
Right, yeah. I mean, it's definitely something that presents as on the probably the more cellular level or genetic level is something different than what they have seen before. However, it is not going around killing people, like, say, Ebola or something like that in Africa, where people get it and almost certainly die.
Well, that's, that's another concern that I know it's a thought, a concern, whatever, that I have in countries that I realize the United States does not have the best healthcare delivery system, but we are far and away in better shape than the entire continent of Africa, not to mention some of the countries there, many countries in Southeast Asia, in Central and South America. And when you stop and think that if this virus gets loose in populations that have none of us have any defenses against it, but populations that don't have the meds that at the beginning would lessen the viral load, stop it from being able to replicate. I mean, my God, we're talking about a major disaster. And right. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Hey, stay in touch, Jason. I got to go.
Hey, thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
All right. Stay in touch. Let us know what's happening out there in the wonderful world of drugs. All right. We have a break. We'll come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. It is 7 past the hour. We're talking about the potential flu pandemic, the H1N1 virus that is trying to survive as all organisms living and the unliving do. And whether or not there is an ethical question about prescriptions for this drug in advance of any symptoms. And the comments so far I found to be very interesting. Obviously, there's not a consensus on this one. And I have to admit, I'm torn between the two. I guess I spent too much of my youth looking at science fiction movies, you know, when I was a kid. This is how they prepared us back in the 50s for the threat of the Soviet Union. We were all to believe that there was a threat out there from outer space or from space creatures, and it was going to get us. And sometimes it involved nuclear things like, and sometimes it wasn't from outer space. I remember the movie Them. That was probably one of the scariest movies I ever saw at the time. It was about giant ants in the in the sewer systems of L.A. They were giant because they had been made radioactive, or their nests had been. Oh, it was real scary. And, you know, I am part of a generation that was conditioned pretty much to be afraid of everything. And I guess that's why I taught myself, and I'm not saying this except for any reason to say I tried to overcome. I taught myself to be afraid of nothing. I have fears, but I'm not afraid of anything, if you understand the distinction there. I think everybody has fears that comes with being a human being. But being afraid of something, I've gone beyond that now. And but I'll tell you, when I was a kid, man, gee whiz, whoa. But that was to prep us, you see. That was Hollywood and the government prepping us for invasion by the Russians or by the Soviets. So worrying about a pandemic now, I guess, is I don't know if it is more rational than worrying about nuclear holocaust back in the 50s and 60s and 70s. They're probably equal in the destructive potential, but you know, the biology of disease is something that has fascinated me. I have two family members now who are in the medical field or studying in the medical field. You know, I just pick up on the conversations or listen to what, you know, what they talk about. And, that whole field of disease transmission and, Plus, during the 80s, I probably had 40 or 50 people that I knew, some very close friends, who died of HIV/AIDS. And this is back in the day where they thought maybe poppers were causing it. Or, I mean, it was just crazy. And I can remember the horror. I lived in Midtown Atlanta when the AIDS virus really became, for this group of people, pandemic, its own pandemic, a Holocaust that ripped through a homosexual population because nobody really knew what the roots of transmission were. And I can remember just feeling the same kind of visceral, just essential level fear that, okay, this seems to be limited to a certain population in which I had many, many friends, people that I loved and cared deeply about. But since I wasn't gay, am I okay? Am I going to survive this? Well, the obvious quick answer back in the day when all this first started was yes. You know, you're safe, Malloy. You don't open yourself to the roots of transmission, anal sex or the, you know, the sharing of body fluids, not necessarily anal sex, but the sharing of body fluids with people who already have this disease. So, you know, my generation, it just seemed like it was one horror after another. And no, it's not all about me. I'm saying my generation. So now this comes along, and I think people in my generation have been conditioned to understand that these things can and will happen. It's one thing to be cynical. I've watched the email over the past couple of days, and the email I've gotten has ranged from people who are genuinely afraid of this to people who, for whatever reason, are mocking the whole thing. It's manufactured by media. It's an attempt to divert attention away from the torture memos. It's the way the pharmaceutical industry is trying to get rich. It originated with a NAFTA inspired pig farm that really should have been in this country, but it was in Mexico. Just on and on. All of which may add to the narrative of why we are now facing this thing. I'm not saying any of this is not part of the narrative of H1N1 flu virus. But I think all of it is just part of. So then it comes down to a question of, okay, this may disappear, like these other flu threats have all disappeared, or gone, you know, submerged itself back into whatever world flu viruses live in, while it decides in whatever way that viruses do how to mutate itself or change itself. So it can, you know, I don't know. I have no idea. Again, I feel like I'm drifting into a 1950s science horror flick. Or you don't have to go back to the 70s. Go to the Andromeda strain. Michael Crichton's book, and then the movie. It's just there. It's just out there. So, what to do? What to do? A couple of emails, and we'll come back to your phone calls. This is from Bob. Mike, I remember 1999 and the looming Y2K computer meltdown that was coming to kill us all. I do. Bob writes, our little boy was going to be born in the first week of the year 2000. During the spring of 1999, I overheard some computer tech guys over lunch talking about this huge remediation project that was eating up all their time and money because the dreaded Y2K was coming. I, at the time, was working as a tech at the Art Institute in Seattle and found out that they were doing nothing to make sure that their systems were Y2K compliant, and they had no plans to do so. I had no idea what might happen January 1st, what systems would work, what systems would fail. All I knew for certain was that a baby was going to be born during the first week of the new century, and if things went south, what would happen? For a very little money, within a few months, we, my wife and I, had enough storable food, cooking fuel, and water that would last us a year. A couple of months later, we had our first aid supplies, office supplies, and a modicum of cash stockpiled. Regardless of what might happen, our new little guy was about as safe as we can make him. During our prepping phase, we were derided for our chicken little mentality. My brother-in-law didn't understand that we were preparing for a possibility. We didn't consider a Y2K meltdown a probability. He knew that nothing was going to happen, so he did nothing. Unfounded certainty is pretty shaky ground as far as I'm concerned. Ever live in California? In the 70s, I heard many, many times that if the big one ever came to shake up Southern Californians, be prepared to be on your own for at least 2 weeks. Food, cooking fuel, water, and first aid supplies. So for the last 9 years, we've kept up the prepping. Earthquakes? They happen up here in the Great Pacific Northwest, too. Economic meltdown? Haven't we seen symptoms at the grocery store over the last year? 1 year ago, a loaf of organic bread cost $3.39. That same loaf today costs $5.25. And I can make a loaf of organic bread from scratch for $1.75. So I do. We rotate and restock regularly. We don't do it looking over our shoulder for the looming catastrophe. We do it because it's cheaper. Will any of this help when flu-bearing werewolves roam our streets in pandemic packs? Who knows? But I don't think making preparations for a probable flu outbreak is either unethical or tinfoil hat history. My 5 pounds of popcorn is not hoarding. For me, that's a couple of months' supply. Bob. Barely getting by. With millions in profits, it's just another lie. Hey, don't it make you red state? Hey, don't it make you red state? Hey, don't it make you red state?
Where is the outrage? Oh, here it is. Back to Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. Talk about a population group that has experienced more than its share of a disaster and of all sorts over the course of its history. Russia. There is a something making the rounds here of the internet now. It's from whatdoesitmean.com. And it reads like, I'm sorry, I'm not laughing because everybody certainly has their own way of expressing themselves. But this says, the headline is, unprecedented tidal wave of death set to overtake the world, warns Russia. And just the first couple of sentences here. Russian health ministry officials reporting to President Medvedev today are warning in the report that the world must prepare for a tidal wave of death of unprecedented dimension due to the current swine flu pandemic sweeping across the globe at frightening speed, raising the concerns of Russian scientists, these reports say, is not the current H1N1 variant of the new swine influenza virus, but its certainty to mix with the much more deadly H5N1 variant known as bird flu. And when that happens, of course, then it's all over. Okay. Well, I appreciate the drama that seems to be genetic in Russians. I really do. And if Larissa Alexandrovna is listening, no offense, sweetheart. I'm just saying, you know. All right, a couple more here. Emails. This is from Benoit, who writes, if there is a pandemic, there absolutely will not be enough Tamiflu or Relenza to go around. Therefore, physicians must prescribe it only for those who actually need it to do otherwise. You might have medicine that you will not ever need, and someone else could die because there's none available. Well, that was one of the thoughts I had today. Jude writes, Mike, when a physician writes a script, it is because a symptom or noted disease process is occurring. Prescribing a medication is not a casual gesture, and one who is focused on our children especially is acutely aware of this. A parent or guardian may be emotionally directed and has the had the possibility of misdiagnosing a piece, Jude, which is, I guess, has to do with the idea that a doctor can be more dispassionate and objective. Whereas I would, call Molly's pediatrician and more or less say, hey, can I have some of that? And the doctor would say, hey, you really don't need it. Justine writes, Mike, the situation regarding Tamiflu is similar to doctors deciding whether to write a prescription in advance for emergency contraception, also known as Plan B. Some GPs and GYNs would strongly advise those of us of childbearing age to have the pills on hand, while others considered it unwise or unethical to do so in the absence of imminent need. Now that Plan B is available without a prescription in many states, it's less of an issue. However, it's still controversial for some who, I guess, would rather see individuals face the consequences of failed contraception, or in the case of the flu, suffer the awful symptoms and possible death. If you feel like crap and are infectious, should you really be heading out to the pharmacy? Wow, what a choice. Annoyed yet again, Justine in Maryland. From Mark. Mike, what happened to letting common sense dictate the following? If you aren't feeling well, you go to your doctor and the doctor diagnoses you, the patient, and prescribes a medication if the doctor deems it necessary. Anymore, as we all know, these legal drug corporations dictate to John Q. Public all these things that are wrong with us and how we should tell our doctor about our problems that we probably did not have anyway. Either common sense and free thought are dead, or the tube literally tells us how to eat, drink, sleep, and think, which obviously goes right down to telling our doctors what's wrong instead of allowing them to do what they went to medical school for nearly 10 years for. Mark. So, in other words, well, yeah, regarding the commercials I was talking about, yeah, I find that maddening when you're watching the evening newscast and they're all of a sudden you see symptoms and drugs and you think, what? Where? I think one of the most violent misuses of what? The pharmaceutical industry? That wouldn't be a misuse. They're the ones doing it. Well, anyway, I find it very offensive, all these drugs for so-called erectile dysfunction. When did it happen that the men in America couldn't get it up anymore? Couldn't get an erection. What? Am I not allowed to say that?
Isn't it about time for you to go to the grocery store?
No. Am I doing it again? Can I not say that? Those aren't cuss words. It's a very normal body reaction is to, get an erection if you're a male. If you're a female. But the point being, when did all of a sudden we had to have four or five of these sorts of drugs on the market?
When Bush became president.
Was that what it was? I guess it was. But I digress.
There was shrinkage, national shrinkage.
We'll be back in a moment. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
The voice inside your head. It's Mike Malloy.
It's about 25 before the hour. Robert is calling from San Francisco, listening. How are you listening, Robert?
I'm listening on the telephone right now, Mike.
Everyone loves a little ass. No one loves a smart ass. How are you listening?
I am. I'm listening on the telephone. You know, Alex Jones, he has an 800 number you can call in on, and a number you just dial in, and then you listen on the phone.
Oh, yeah?
But I was listening. I've been trying to listen to you. It's become a lot harder. I only get your podcast, you know.
Well, you can listen to us on Green 960. We're just delayed.
Yeah, I know, but you see, the director there from our 960, he... I think he's a bit of a gatekeeper because even Rhodes he put on delayed in order to play Schultz delayed. And we don't get anything past, 12 o'clock with Hartman. But that kind of makes me wonder about some of these program directors.
Well, I've always wondered about program directors. But John at Green 960 is, trust me on this, he's a good guy.
Yeah, I know, but still he hasn't explained why he doesn't have anything or much live in the afternoon.
Call him up. He's real open.
I think he's afraid of me.
No, he's real open to talking to listeners, but that's not why you called.
No, you already hit the high point there with the whatdoesitmean.com. You know, that's one of my main sources of information, Mike.
Well, you know, that's a pretty shaky site.
Well, but the thing is, if you look at that, and this is how Air Force One ties in with this flu thing. Allegedly, Obama was going to New York to talk to Russian and Chinese diplomats at the UN. And now imagine if Obama is in Air Force One at the time, what is going on? Because it looks like evasive maneuvers at low altitude. Why would a pilot do that? A pilot might do that if he wanted witnesses to see what was happening over a highly populated area. And I look at that, what goes on in that video, and I'm just blown away. It makes absolutely no sense to me.
Well,
except what I heard or what you see from whatdoesitmean.com.
Well, there's also, you've heard of Occam's razor, all things being equal, usually the most the briefest explanation is usually the one that's most correct. They were up there taking, it was, in my opinion, a serious error in judgment. They decided to take pictures of the New York skyline.
That seems like quite a lame cover story, though. You know, it's
well,
like
I, you know, it may be, but I'm just, you know, I've got so many things ricocheting around inside of the vast emptiness in my head that I just can't add one more thing that somehow this sending up Air Force Nine or whatever the hell it was, this huge jumbo jet. You know, anyone who came up with that idea is a certifiable psychopath anyway.
Yeah, that's why I don't believe. That's why I don't believe the cover story. It's a lot like the Rayburn parking garage scenario, May 31st, 2006, where they claim elevator guys were using Hilti guns doing work, and then you find out later that there possibly was a gunfight underneath there, and agents were British and Israeli agents were fighting American and French agents over information from Floco.
I know, but what about Tamiflu and germ warfare?
Well, I just happened to. Notice that article that links to avian N5H1, I think it is, avian flu. And they're saying that these two flus get together, it could be a real problem for people. And the vaccines, problem, reaction, solution. Somebody's creating a problem. 80 of the top world microbiologists have disappeared, allegedly, since 2001. And not just Joe Blows, but the best of the best have disappeared. And then all of a sudden you see this kind of scenario happening, and you know a problem, reaction, solution. You don't want the solution they've got. There could be something in a vaccine that that people might not like. So there are other prophylactics that you could use, essential oils, salves, with beeswax and olive oil, or ozonated oils, or colloidal silver, high quality stuff. Those are all things too, but you've got to kind of be prophylactic and work on your own. And I would take it seriously, but I definitely think there's problem, reaction, solution in this.
Well,
and look at the people who benefit. I mean, in that article, it goes into Rumsfeld and the Bush and anthrax and all this stuff. And there's people made a lot of money on Cipro. On anthrax, and I got to tell you, these guys are real rats, and I wouldn't put it past them.
Well, I've got to move on. I hear what you're saying, and other than the What Really Happened website, we're probably in agreement on most of this stuff. I guess. I mean, I don't know anymore. I have no idea. I don't know what's real. I really don't. Bruce writes in, one thing has my anxiety level up a couple of notches. Normally, a flu outbreak report would go into the media hype pile. But flu shouldn't spread this late in the year. The lab here, where he lives, had already switched over to tracking summer diseases like West Nile. God. Yeah, okay.
Can't you make him stop?
Nan is calling from St. Louis, listening on XM. Hey, Nan.
Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hey, the last guy that just called in.
Yeah.
This is something that nobody has brought up very much, but there were three virologists that I was listening to on the BBC, and supposedly this particular strain replicates and becomes more virulent in a healthy immune system, and that's why they're finding it so strange.
Yeah, and it causes
so the building up your immune system may not be the best thing to do at this particular
right. Time. I've read the same information, and that seems to be one of the reasons that otherwise healthy people who normally can handle the flu very easily, people between the ages of say 20 and 50, are being really hit with this particular virus, where the very young and the very old, it seems like the virus is not really all that interested. I don't know. But yes, I've read the same thing you're talking about.
But okay, my response to your dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
I've kind of found, for me anyway, because anything coming from the government, I go from the standpoint that you're guilty until you prove to me you're innocent.
Mm-hmm.
But I, for me, in most everything, it's like, don't question, don't second guess yourself. Trust your instincts and don't second guess yourself. And you know, It usually ends up to be the right decision. And if it's not, the teacher will keep coming until you get the lesson right.
Well, yeah, except if the lesson, if you get it wrong the first time, and you die.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Keep the Tamiflu.
Okay. All right. I can't take it back. And I certainly, the drugstore wouldn't take it back. Nan, thanks. I appreciate you checking in. My idea is very simply is, if I develop these specific symptoms to, this particular virus, sure, I'm not going to go in the backyard and start chanting and, wait for the great envelope to close around me. I definitely will take the Tamiflu and then go in the backyard and start chanting and wait for the great envelope. I don't know what to do. I really don't. That's why I brought it up. I've been saying for years on this program, I have no answers. You know, I'm not Rush Limbaugh. He knows everything. I don't know anything. I know absolutely nothing. Who sent this? Eileen. Mike, love your show. Thought you may find this article interesting. In case you have not heard of Dr. Mercola, he is to healthcare what you are to politics. I forwarded this to all the people I know. It does state the Tamiflu has been outlawed in Japan for children. Also, for those who really need it, if it's not hoarded, or if it is hoarded, it is not accessible. On the Today Show this morning, they said it is completely sold out in Manhattan. As the following article states, Tamiflu symptoms are the same as the flu and really only shorten the sickness by a day or so. So what's the point? P.S. Love the pick of Representative Bachman. Oh, yeah, on today's website, today's live blog that Kathy writes. I write Malloy's daily blog, and she writes the live blog. She has that picture of Michelle Bachman and
Bat Boy. You got to go see it.
You got to see it. If you haven't seen
it. Take no credit for that. It was just serendipity that I found it on the internets, and it's beautiful.
It is. I know about all the deaths in children in Japan who took Tamiflu. Now that's a genetic anomaly because the Japanese are very homogeneous people. I don't know. Again, I have no idea. No answers. I guess, though, it's making me nervous, you know? This is from Michael, who writes, "Don't knock Viagra." He writes, "Mike, all my adult life, I've sporadically had difficulty with Mr. Happy's performance. Finally, a doctor said, hey, try this. The drug is amazing, life-altering, transformational." Michael, yeah, okay, I'm just saying, you know, what about, you know, the centuries and eons before somebody came up with Viagra, you know? I realize some men have definite problems with, there are some physical restrictions, some situations that cause erectile dysfunction, but everybody? Thanks to the crew, all both of us. Well, no, actually, here in the studio, it's all both of us. But Ben Birch is our technical advisor. Sharon Gordy is our military affairs correspondent. Bruce Enberg, our economic affairs correspondent. And the ethical advisors are Bob Alexander and Bridget Wolf. Catherine Bay, engineers and produces this program. Rick is calling from Dover, Delaware, listening on Sirius. Hey, Rick.
Hey, good evening, Mike.
Hi.
Hey, listen, I think this would be a great time for the Democrats to really push universal health care with this flu going around. Mm-hmm. You know, the last thing we need is U.S. citizens that don't have health care that could be coming down with something, whether it's the flu or not, afraid to go to a health care provider because they don't have health care because they might just go bankrupt because of the cost involved. And I just wanted to get maybe your take on that.
Well, that's an excellent point. And I think it applies to anyone who either political party that might be in power. Over the years, I think Nixon talked about universal health care. I know Kennedy talked about it, and nobody's ever done it. And but I think this is you're pointing out the perfect example of why it's necessary. How many people in this country right now are without health insurance? Is it it's anywhere from 30 to 50 million, I think, at any given time.
Right.
And what happens when those people realize that a course of this antiviral on the open market is $150. Not only do they not have a job, but they don't have health insurance to A, go to the doctor for a diagnosis, and then B, go to a pharmacy to pick up the script. I mean, this is horrifying stuff.
Right.
And this is where it's really clear, I think, to anyone with a brain that we have our priorities so screwed that we are spending hundreds of billions of dollars a year on these two wars and nothing for our people back home here for healthcare. It's insane. I don't get this.
Not only the wars, but also a lot of foreign aid. I read an article, and you know, once some of these articles, you don't know if they're true or not. I'll give you an example, Israel. We give Israel $3 billion a year in aid, and I'm not sure if those figures are right, but if we cut back some foreign aid, I really truly believe there's ways we could afford universal health care. We didn't, you know, whether we had to cut back money from giving to the banks or some elsewhere, some pet projects that a lot of politicians have going on, all the time. But I really think there's a way we could definitely.
Well,
do it.
I think there is. There's only so much available funds, whether it's our money or money we borrow.
Right.
Israel, Egypt, and Colombia, I think between those three countries, those are the three, and I think I have them in the proper order, or it may be now Israel, Colombia, and Egypt. But those are the three countries that get the most in foreign aid from the United States, and I think it adds up to about $6 or 7 billion a year. I don't know if that would, I doubt seriously if that would provide universal health care, but it would damn sure help in getting us there. This is something I've never been able to understand why, and I mean that, why we don't have, why health care in this country especially is considered a privilege rather than a right. That just seems crazy. And every single politician that I know of, regardless of his political party, with the exception, I guess, of Ralph Nader and Dennis Kucinich, every single and maybe Richard Nixon, for God's sake, every other single politician I've ever heard of has done everything possible to prevent it from happening. So it's a mystery to me. All right,
well,
listen, yeah, go ahead.
Thank you for your time, Mike. I appreciate it.
All right, take care, Rick. Appreciate your call. That to me is really a no-brainer, isn't it? I mean, universal health care. You know, and one of the arguments I hear against it is that, well, if we have single payer, I choose to call it single payer. That doesn't mean the government. I'm not talking about the English or the British system where the doctors actually work for the government. I'm talking about the Canadian system in New Zealand or the Scandinavian countries where the physicians are in private practice. It's just that the government provides the insurance, essentially. That's kind of what's going on. Sort of like all members of Congress get, or sort of like Medicare, or sort of like Medicaid, you know, those terrible programs that don't seem to work worth a damn. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. But why we don't have universal health care, single-payer health care in this country is just, I mean, if someone would need proof of our insanity, that would be it.
Well, would that mean everybody got free Viagra?
Oh, God. You know, I should learn not to bring up stuff that you find stupid because you just don't let me forget it, do you?
Will you get some coleslaw when you go to the store? I know you're mainly going for like salt and water and boxes of macaroni, but
that's right. You're damn right. Well, I'll tell you what. You know, when the bug hits, if you want something to eat, come and talk to me. I'll see about whether
see if you have any Viagra.
Whether Molly and I can spare to share with you.
I'm trying to lose a little weight, so.
Thanks for hanging out tonight, all right? I hope to see you tomorrow night. Don't, be careful, right? Or whatever. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.